The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
And we are back here on Analyze This, and I want to thank my good friends, Ronnie Russell and Dwayne Henry, for joining us in hour number one to give some perspective locally and, of course, internationally what's taking place over there in England. Now we're going to shift to a good topic for me. I'm a history major, so I'm looking forward to hearing what we got to say. You could take off the mask if you want to know, because I go to that, all right? The Society of Black Archaeologists are in the house. And, you know, I can just yield to Justin Donovan. Uh-huh. That's you?
That's me.
I pronounce it correctly?
Yep, you did good.
Okay, good. Yeah. And the PhD, and he's a chairman of the board. And Ayana Omelade Fluellen.
Yes.
PhD, and she is the current president. Good morning to everybody here.
Good morning.
I'm going to let you introduce everybody else as well, so let me yield to the yes. president. Good morning, Madam President.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Ayana Omelade Fluellen. I'm the current president and one of the co-founders of the Society of Black Archaeologists. Mm-hmm. I'm joined here with our co-founder as well, Dr. Justin Donovant. We're also here with Dr. William White.
You took a share of that? No, you took a share of that. Okay.
Got it. Good morning.
You can push it back. You can watch some more. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, thanks. That's much better.
Yeah.
And we're also here with Benjamin Siegel, who's a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley.
Hi, everyone.
Good morning. Can speak a little close in the mic?
Sure. Hello.
There we go. And who's your cameraman?
Oh, the cameraman over here is Dave, who's been doing fantastic work. He's actually been documenting our entire archaeological field season down at the Estate Little Princess, which is the headquarters for the Nature Conservancy. So we're so excited to have him and can't wait for all of the images and video that he'll put together.
Okay, good. I'm going to start with to my left and work my way back this way. So, Dr. Donovan, you're a gator?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. PhD, University of Florida.
You got BA in history.
Yes, BA in history and anthropology from Howard.
I got BA in history, but I'm a University of Miami Hurricane, so we don't really like you guys.
I got you. No worries.
I'm letting you know straight up. Okay, we're good with that, right? Young man, your name again?
I'm Ben Siegel.
Ben Siegel, you are Cal Bear.
Yeah, PhD candidate at University of California.
University of California out in Berkeley. Yeah, that's good country. Yeah. Oh, there's nice. And you, Doc, your last name?
My name is Bill White. I'm a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley.
Oh, you out there as well?
Yeah.
Okay, out in the Bay Area. And young lady, you're a Longhorn?
I was a Longhorn.
You were a Longhorn, yeah.
I got my PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm currently an assistant professor at Stanford University.
Wow. We got all this brain power in here. So, burnt orange?
Absolutely.
That's it, right? I know you like that. So check this out. What prompted the creation of the Society of Black Archaeologists, which was created in 2011?
All right. Yeah, so that's a loaded question, I guess you could say. I was doing my PhD at University of Florida back in 2011 when I ran into now Dr. Ayana Fluellen as an undergraduate student. And as you can expect, there weren't too many black people studying archaeology at the University of Florida then.
Mm-hmm.
So we got together, had a little meeting conversation. We went to a Association of Black Psychologists conference meeting and saw the space that these black psychologists were able to create within the field. And so as we were driving back to Gainesville, Florida, we asked ourselves, what would it take to create a society of black archaeologists? And we had a listserv of all the black archaeologists we knew. We sent an email out and said, if you don't want to be a part of this organization, respond to us. And nobody responded. So that started the organization.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is 11 years in the making?
11 years in the making, correct.
And what about funding? Because everything requires resources. We live in a capitalistic society. It is what it is. So how do you go about generating funds to keep this movement and the need for this you know, history, you know, I'm pro-history, so yeah. I'm all about this. So
yeah,
how do you go about doing that?
That's a critical question. You know, we're like project-oriented and vision-oriented first. Mm-hmm. So we said, what do we want to do and how do we want to do it? And then we'll see what actual finances we need. Mm-hmm. A lot of times as nonprofits, the first assumption is money, but really the people power is what drives these organizations. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to be a support network for each other. And now that we're an international organization, we want to be a support network for our archaeological colleagues in Brazil, Cameroon, Mozambique, and all these other areas. So now money's becoming a conversation to support them. We've gotten support from Hulu in the past. Mm-hmm. They've sent a donation to us, support from the Slave Wrecks Project to support our initial funding from the Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. And then just generous donations from viewers and listeners has been instrumental in keeping us going.
That's awesome. Dr. Flewellyn. Mm. He's the youngest, right? You're the baby in here, right? right, because you're a student. But what is it about the stories being told and not necessarily as accurately as they should be that drives the need for Black archaeology?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that Justin and I really wanted to focus on, not only creating a network for archaeologists of African descent, but really creating the platform to talk more deeply about African diasporic history worldwide, right? Mm-hmm. And what it means to have people of African descent doing the storytelling. So many of the sites that are excavated that have to do with African heritage, African diasporic history, are excavated by non-Black individuals. And oftentimes that history then becomes extrapolated in different ways. The story is really to push forth a different kind of narrative. But something that Justin and I are really working towards, and a lot of the members of the SBA, is really saying, you know, what does it mean for us to be at the helm of sharing our stories, right? What does it mean for us to take charge of that history, not only in the creation of it, but the telling of it as well, and creating space for younger students after us to do the same. Mm-hmm. And I think it breathes more space into Black experiences and the richness and fullness of our experiences, because what we're shared about Black history in our textbooks is often flat and truncated, mm-hmm. right? But we're here to really flesh out the fullness of Black people and Black history.
That's what we're talking about. Dr. Ben, right? Your name's Ben, right?
Bill.
Bill.
He's
Bill.
Ben.
Okay, Bill and Ben. Okay, good. So Bill, you're a professor.
Yep.
What are you grasping from a more open-minded, aggressive student in the new millennium, as opposed to those of us back in the day who were just processing what we were told?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've been doing archaeology for a while. I think more than 20 years or about 20 years. And one of the things that's really great about the students of today is they are flexible and they are willing to go in directions that in the past we weren't necessarily allowed to go or even willing to go.
Oh, well, have access to go to that. They got access that we didn't have.
Sure,
with
sure.
The internet and all that stuff.
That's another huge thing too, because even the program that we're doing here on St. Croix, in the past, students pay to go to archaeological field school, mm-hmm. but in our case, they get a stipend. So they're, you know, one of the biggest things that we realized is that it was only a certain social class, economic class, that could put all their bills on hold for 6 weeks and come with us around the world to do archaeology. And by giving folks stipends, it really opens up the door to other people who couldn't otherwise afford to go and do an archaeological field school. Yeah. And so in that way, you know, this is kind of, we've started to see this happen with more projects, where more projects are giving students stipends because they're realizing that the flow of archaeologists is diversified when people are given these options.
That's awesome. And Ben, as a student, right, pull the microphone. Mm-hmm. What's your take, knowing that, you know, you happen to be living in a time where you could pick up your cell phone and have access to information that we could only dream of when we were going to school in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it's definitely...
pull the microphone closer, sure. So you'll be more comfortable when you're talking.
Yeah, it's definitely about a very different type of information, different style of learning, mm-hmm. that you want to give to your students at this point, because as you point out, right, the access to the just, you know, rote knowledge, just the data points, is accessible to everybody now, just in the pocket of their phone, or in their phone in their pocket. Mm-hmm. And so what it really is about is it's about asking the right kinds of questions. and helping to develop young minds to be able to ask the kinds of questions that will help them find the answers. Instead of just reifying what they already know or what they already think they want to know, you have to help them develop their research questions in a way that helps them seek information from multiple sources and helps them identify sources that are actually worth quoting and actually worth listening to, as opposed to just all of the noise that might come in through social media or, non-peer-reviewed websites, just, kind of spewing forth whatever information they feel like putting on the internet. That's very different from actual research or actual information produced by scientists who are getting peer review, who are going through the actual steps to collect that data.
What's it like going to a school that has a history for being, I don't want to say radical, but, Cal Berkeley, everybody knows if you want to be a protesting student, Cal Berkeley's a good school to go to. I'm serious.
Yes.
We know about this.
Yeah. No, it's real. Just last year, there was all the departments with student employees who were working as GSIs, graduate student instructors. Mm-hmm. They were all becoming strike ready. In solidarity with actually at UC Santa Cruz, there's a lot of concerns about insufficient pay for the graduate student employees. Housing costs in California are ridiculous right now. Mm-hmm. And so watching in real time my department getting ready to strike and refuse to show up to work, Berkeley definitely lives up to that reputation.
Without a doubt. Ayana, you wanted to say something?
I wanted to add on this notion around like students and student experiences.
Turn the microphone so you can get it directly. There you go.
That's better. Yeah. Great. Yeah. So as Dr. William White was discussing, we have two different programs occurring at the Estate Little Princess right now that we've been doing actually for the last 3 years. So mm-hmm. in partnership with Archaeology in the Community, which is run by Dr. Alexander Jones, and in conversation and collaboration with the Caribbean Center for Boys and Girls, mm-hmm. we actually host a 1 to 2 week field school for youth here on the island completely free of charge, where high school students on St. Croix are actually coming out to the estate, getting a deep dive into archaeological knowledge, theory, practice, excavating alongside us, sifting, sorting, and doing that sort of interpretive work with us to really expose them.
You said you've been there for 3 years now?
Yes. And, we came, that should have.
No, you're there for 3 years, and this is the first time I see you on my show, and I've been out here for 2 years now.
That's so true. Yeah. We've been down here since 2017.
Well, I mean,
I know.
Man, I should just kick you guys out right now, man, for being negligent. No, I'm just joking. I'm just joking. But that's good. Justin, let me get back to you, right? Yes. You went to Howard?
Yes, sir. HU all the way.
Now, Howard resonates in the Virgin Islands. Mm-hmm. Our history here in what Howard has provided for many a Virgin Islander mm-hmm. is that if there's one university that that transcends mm-hmm. with our evolution as a people, in particular on a leadership level, is Howard University. Mm-hmm. What was it like going to Howard originally? Where are you from originally?
Yeah, I'm from Maryland originally.
You're from Maryland originally, yeah. So you're a homeboy, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What was it like going there and seeing people just going to Howard University because it's the renowned Black university, the flagship Black university in America?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I tell people all the time, my time at Howard was probably my most transformative experience. I went to university early, so I started at 16.
Okay.
And at that age, I was still very early in terms of forming my identity, mm-hmm. in terms of what I wanted to study and be and grow up and all those things. And going to Howard and seeing all these Black professionals in every field, having peers from all over the world that were into everything from skateboarding to surfing to marine biology, mm-hmm. all of those elements just completely opened up the entire world to me in a new way. And then having professors that poured so much into me. When they found out I wanted to do archaeology, I had history professors saying, what can we do to support? I had the janitors in the building mm-hmm. telling me, like, keep going, we need you. And all of that influence just poured into this need to do this archaeological work, to see and create this bigger vision.
Yeah, man. Howard Hampton and Morgan State. Those three in that area, that Baltimore, D.C., Virginia area, has definitely had an impact on us. Let me get back to the professor here. Bill, right? Bill, right?
Yeah, that's me.
William White?
That's what William White, the third.
William White. Where are you from?
I'm from Idaho.
Potato country, man.
Well, you all get all the good ones. Yeah. We sell those.
Yeah. So, you know something? Tell the public about Idaho. My audience, I got a great audience. That's actually the strength of the show is really my audience, right? We know when we hear Idaho, we think potato, but that part of the country is arguably the most beautiful part of the country.
Well, I mean, I would say, but I don't want anyone else to know that.
No, it is what it is. The further west you get, the more natural it gets. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Outdoors, that's the way of life there. Yeah. So, you know, someone was asking me the other day what it's like to grow up there. And I mean, we spend a lot of time outside. There's mountains, rivers, deserts, forests. I mean, camping was just an everyday thing. The stuff that you see on reality TV shows and stuff was just the weekend for us. So being outside and exploring, you know, I learned early on that being outside was something I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I still sometimes wonder, why do I spend so much time indoors?
I like that. Ben, where are you from?
I'm originally from Miami, Florida, actually, but I bounced around quite a bit.
You're in this part of the world. How'd you get out of California?
Long story, I guess. The shortest version I can tell is
pull the microphone a little closer.
Yeah, went to school in Atlanta, Georgia, at Emory, for a master's degree in history. Then went on to East Carolina University for a master's degree in underwater archaeology. Spent 10 years working in the CRM industry, and then met up with Bill, actually, via email. Found out he was working down here in St. Croix. I'm very interested in kind of the environmental impacts of sugar planting across the Caribbean and the southeastern U.S. And so it was a perfect match, and I was accepted to Berkeley and moved out there to start my PhD.
What's it like knowing that heaven on earth actually exists on St. Croix?
On St. Croix.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, the Virgin Islands in particular, but St. Croix, we're more flat. You know, you've been to St. Thomas?
Not yet.
You haven't gone over there yet? Eventually, you're going to work your way over there, St. Thomas and St. John. It's more mountainous and all that stuff. Over here is more flat. But this is heaven.
Yeah. I really like the sandy beaches and the warm water. I've been made fun of in other parts of the country for having learned to dive in, they call it crystal clear bath water.
Yeah.
and so when I try and dive up in North Carolina and it's all silty and you can't see 6 feet in your face. No,
That's a whole different.
Yeah, not whole, too interested.
Whole, that's a whole different thing. And Ms. Fluellen, where are you from originally?
I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and raised in Miami, Florida, with deep roots like 1850s in Texas.
Wow. Wow. This is awesome. So check this out. We're going to go for our first break. When we come back, and we're going to talk Africa. Okay?
Sounds good.
And the one of the things that we do here on this show is we've learned that literally everything in our existence cycles back to Africa, including Latin music and all that stuff, right? With the drums and all that stuff. So we're gonna have a good conversation. We got the Society of Black Archaeologists here joining us today. We got Dr. Bill, we got Dr. Donovan, we got Dr. Fluellen, and we're gonna soon have Dr. Ben in a little bit, right? So we'll be back right after this.
Welcome to Banking for Your Business. At Bank of St. Croix, we have many ways by which you can mind your business, including checking and savings accounts and merchant card services. And the mobile app and online banking provide access 24/7. Bank of St. Croix has two locations, one in Galas Bay at 340-773-8500 and one in Peters Rest, 340-713-8500. Bank of St. Croix, bankofstcroix.com.
Sometimes you need a moment to just step back, relax, and listen to your favorite song. I'm Raina Duris, and on the next World Cafe, maybe I can help you find something new to love, or maybe remind you of something you've been missing. There's so much music out there to enjoy, so take a moment, take a breath, and tune in to World Cafe.
Weekdays at 10 p.m. on WTJX FM
93.1. Hey, it's me, your cell phone. We need to talk about something. Something serious. I know you love me. I know you like using me wherever you are. But I feel like this isn't working out when you're driving. I know you may think that it's possible to focus both on me and the road. But I just don't feel the same way. I think we should spend time away from each other when you're driving. It's for the best.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Features ideas and voices from some of the best minds of this generation and previous ones, including activists, muckrakers, visionaries, artists, risk takers, academics, and just folks, as in the most just folks, who share a commitment to truth, democracy, justice, diversity, equality, and peace.
Catch Democracy Now! Weekdays at 11 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.
So we're back in effect, and my guests are getting comfortable here. A couple of them on the couch and all that stuff. You can see the reason why it's easy to come to work in the morning, right?
You got
that awesome vista and all that stuff. So my audience has started to weigh in. So since I'm going to defer to my audience, we'll get to Africa a little bit. Now, one of my co-hosts, we do a Monday table talk. He's a former senator. He's now executive director for the Public Services Commission, Donald Oskold. He said to ask you guys if you've seen the movie Great Pyramid, K 2019, director Femi Krasniqi. So you guys got some homework, okay? So I'll be sending you guys this, all right? Okay, so look out for that, and then I'll get you back in, and you can submit your reports and all that stuff, and we go for that. Now, another question from Wallace Williams. He's a librarian. He's been here since the 70s. He asks a good question. Generally, how stable is science in the territory? What's the level of cooperation and coordination with your organization's archaeologists in the territory?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish we had Dr. Here, is that better? Sorry.
It's okay, it's okay.
I wish we had Dr. Alexander Jones to actually come in and speak on the topic. One of the main things that we did when we initially were setting up this project, especially in regards to the youth field school program, mm-hmm. was actually look at the curriculum in K-12 schools to actually determine how we would then teach archaeological theory practice to students here. So the program itself is designed in conversation with curriculum already developed and taught in schools on the island. So that's one way that we're ensuring that there's a sort of coherence, I think, between mm-hmm. the two. Justin.
Yeah, Dr. Donovan.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I mean, everybody here has been super supportive in terms of the work we're trying to do. We've, of course, talked to all the archaeologists that currently work here, of course, government officials as well. They've been supportive in terms of letting us borrow equipment, helping answer questions about things that we find for the first time, and giving us some guidance as to where they think it originates. And I think all of that stems from this clear understanding that we need more Virgin Islanders in heritage professional organizations mm-hmm. and government positions. This is a critical place for anybody who, I mean, you all know it because you all live here, mm-hmm. but in reality, in collaboration and in relation to the rest of the Caribbean, VI is highly significant. And then in connection and collaboration with the United States, it's a very significant place. I tell people second major successful slave rebellion, that's, you don't find that everywhere.
What did you say? Second, is it?
Second, yeah. Second major successful slave.
Second, is it?
Haiti was first. I got to give it to Haiti. Haiti had the first one. I got to keep the facts.
Because I was saying John Rebellion was no joke.
It wasn't no joke. You're right. You're right.
And since you went there, you know, this is one of my pet peeves. And my audience, they're probably getting upset with me saying this over and over again, but, you know, we're 11 years away from my 300th anniversary with the St. John Rebellion, and we got to be the ones telling the story.
100%.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm sorry. You know, we got a lot of artists to come in here on Thursdays, normally our Thursday, and I'm trying to tell them we got to form some type of consortium, you know, to actually make sure that that story is told as authentically as and accurately, more anything else, as it should be told. And, I'm, you know, I want to be a part of that. And, you know, I understand economics. We're y'all ain't really into money. Like, artists ain't really into money. But money is in art, and money is in history, right? And if there's anybody who's going to be compensated, it should be those who be doing the homework and doing the research. That's just how it is. I'm sorry, but, you know, we live, the dollar runs things. Yeah. It is what it is. So, you know, we're 11 years away. You know, we had our emancipation. We actually have our 175th emancipation coming up next year, right? Because we had the 158th in 1998. So we got a number of different things that's going to be happening. We actually have a 150th anniversary for Contract Day. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of Contract Day with Queen Mary and all that stuff in Denmark. That's coming up in 2028. So we got three different big anniversaries beginning next year, 5 years later, and then 5 years after that. So just wanted to put that on the record. Now, let's talk about Africa. And Dr. Donovan, you mentioned the Virgin Islands and the conduit that we are, right? I think that's a good term, right? Our forefathers brought here, dropped off on different islands all the way from Trinidad, or actually from northern South America, right? Suriname and that whole area, Guyana, all the way up through the archipelago, right? But we had other forefathers here. We had the Indians, right? We had our, the Arawaks, the Caribs, what have you. And they, and the Tainos, right? And they, for some reason, don't get a level of respect that they deserve, right? Now, I know you're into black archaeology, and we've been talking about Africa, but why is it that the Tainos and the Arawaks who were here don't get the kind of respect that they deserve? Anybody can answer that question based on whatever research you may have done so far.
Yeah, I'll just kick it off with just, I think the most important thing is that there's been an intentional erasure of that history and that current presence of Taino and Arawak people throughout the Caribbean and Caribbean.
It ain't limited to the Virgin Islands, no.
But it's intentional. When we look at archaeological records from the 1930s, you had Danish archaeologists literally excavating here and taking things back to Denmark. So when you come up here 100, 200, 300 years later, you just assume that they didn't leave anything for us to see. But really, it was intentionally extracted and taken other places. So part of our role and our mission is to tell this full and complete story as we come to know it. This is why diversifying archaeology is so important. We come in with the African connection, recognizing that there are indigenous people that came before us here on this place. We need indigenous archaeologists to come out and do that as well. We need Asian archaeologists to come out and talk about the Indian presence that was here. We need all kinds of different people coming together to tell this complete human story.
Mr. Professor, what's your take? Because I see you shaking your head as if you know that what we're talking about is accurate.
Yeah, it totally is accurate. And one of the first places we start with our research is always trying to identify those Taino, Arawak, Carib presences at the sites first, because we've been asked to look at other places, and we found out that there were excavations, you know, almost 100 years ago. Our first question is, what happened to those records? What happened to those artifacts, the photographs that people were taking? And in some cases, you know, human remains. What were archaeologists, antiquarians doing in the Danish colonial time, the transitional time to the United States? Where are those things? And one of the things that we've been focusing on as State Little Princess is trying to do our very best to identify those indigenous archaeological signatures if they're present. And so far, we haven't found anything conclusive, but we know other places here on St. Croix, there are indigenous sites.
Have you been to the Wim Great House yet?
Yeah, we have.
What about the Wim Great House that jumped out at you based on what you found there?
Well, we didn't do archaeology there. We only...
No, just in general. Just in general. Because it's a historic site, and there's a lot of records in there. Of course, now we're in a digitizing era, right? And sometimes you don't necessarily want to do that because it takes away from the authenticity. Mm-hmm. But from a preservation standpoint, it's the best way to go.
Yeah, we definitely need to digitize things. But as you were mentioning, from a use standpoint too, it's really important to go back to the original archives, because if we digitize it and put it all online, these archives that need us to come and use them, the human presence isn't there. There aren't researchers going there. But mm-hmm. I think, Dr. Flo Ellen, you went to WIM archives and checked things out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back in 2019, I spent a couple of extra months here after our field season, really making, really diving deep into the archives at the WIM plantation and also the smaller archival collection that's at the St. George Botanical Gardens. And it actually is, it's a shame to know the impact of climate change, especially on the WIM plantation, mm-hmm. the stability of the archival building, and also knowing that through climate change, we know that the instability of archives here on island is truly in dire need. Mm-hmm. And it's important to keep those archives here. It's important to invest in the spaces here that hold on to that history, that share that history with Crucians.
Yeah, without a doubt. So Ben, I come into you because I'm not gonna hold back any longer. Pull a microphone, right? Okay. You come in here with this Rastaman vibration look, with Marley with that nice hat on your head, yeah. Right? been laughing and check. That guy like the look, you know what I'm saying? But you are now a student working on your PhD, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you got multiple masters.
Yes.
You're a career student.
Well, I've put, 10 years into the private sector of archaeology, so I'm back for more punishment.
You look 25, but your history sunk 45.
Yeah, no, I'll be 38 this November.
That's what I'm talking about. You know what I'm saying? So it's all good. No, you heard Che Guevara. You know about Che?
Yeah, well, a little bit.
Well, I'll fill you in here. And the reason why I want to use Che is, of course, you know, he was a revolutionary originally from South America, and he worked his way up. And he and Fidel did what they had to do in Cuba, and then when they gained the power, he tells Fidel, "I'm out," and Fidel is telling him, "Well, why you want to leave now? We've gotten to where we want to get. We got control," and Che tells him, "Well, I got more people that need to get free. So I go into Angola," right? Which is the connection now for this conversation for Africa. Isn't mental liberation a part of archaeology as well? It isn't just about finding out what our ancestors did back in the day and what they were about and what they represented. It's about a freedom, a freedom of, by knowing who we are and where we come from, it allows us to be mentally free.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think drawing connections from the past to the present is also a really important part of it. So kind of uncovering the legacy of the deeds done in the past, of the harm done, of the pain caused. My work in particular focuses on the environmental legacy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really trying to drill into, centuries of sugar planting out here. What has that done to the soil? What has that done to the water mm-hmm. reserves on island? And where does that leave us today?
How long have you been on Sugar?
Been here about a month so far. I'll be here maybe through the end of July.
Okay. Now, if one of the things you'll learn, if you get to experience it, since you're into soil, is that we got the most fertile soil here on St. Croix. And for some reason, any kind of rain, a brown patch will turn green in a day and a half.
Yeah.
So those are the things you're looking at. Is that what you're talking about, sir?
Yeah. We're going to the local farmers market mm-hmm. on Saturdays to talk to locals and get their experience on soil health out here, mm-hmm. erosion, see how they're dealing with the drought, their take on what might be causing those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the estate Little Princess, we're also conducting quite a few soil tests out there. To get a look at the development of soil over time, perhaps before and after sugar planting, and to also kind of look at the chemical signature and see soil fertility and what's going on there.
No, man, I like him what you're telling me, because basically, Professor White, Ben is articulating specializations within archaeology. It's not just this broad area of study. There's different areas and all that we could focus on that could actually make where the sum of the parts equal a great whole.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because all of us here really specialize in archaeology of the African diaspora, but of the thousands of archaeologists around the world, there's so many different specialties. And what's great is, because of our position and, you know, the work that we're doing, folks are coming from different parts of the world and they have these other questions, other things they've discovered elsewhere. And we get to listen and participate and hear what they're doing and try to see if that applies to the work that we're doing.
Yeah, without a doubt. I could call you first name, Ayana?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm going to do that. Dr. Flewellyn, check this out, right? When I think of Africa, I think of oil up top, food in the middle, and gold down in the bottom. Mm-hmm. That's accurate? South Africa, diamonds and all that stuff down in South Africa. In the middle of the mother country, you could actually grow, you know, the land there is more harvesting. And then, of course, up top, a lot of oil up there.
Yeah, when I think about Africa, I know a lot of people focus on the resources, the natural resources that are available throughout the continent. Mm-hmm. Something that we all like to focus on, especially within African diaspora archaeology, are the knowledges that the people of that land held and how those knowledges actually influenced the economies that grew here in the Americas, right? Like the rice economy, being able to actually know, cultivate in particular ways these cash crops that then made these European countries very wealthy. So there's so much richness that comes out of the continent of Africa, from oil, from gold, from these natural resources, as well as the people themselves that hold so much knowledge about the land, how to cultivate the land, how to be in right relationship to this land. And we tap into all of that when we're doing our archaeological work.
Now, Egyptian history, right? Okay. Egypt is part of Africa, right?
Absolutely.
Right? I'll make sure.
Right?
The reason why I bring it up, we had a doctor from St. Croix, originally from St. Croix, well, Puerto Rico, but he raised up on St. Croix, born from St. Croix, Dr. Ben. And he lived in New York for a lot of years. And he would take a lot of Virgin Islanders over on an Egyptian excursion. And he passed away in 2015. And that history is, that's about engineering and science, right? Over there with the pyramids and all that stuff, right? So everything, you know, that's us today actually came from the motherland.
Oh, absolutely. And I think about, you can think about, you know, amazing kingdoms coming out of Kemet. You can think about amazing kingdoms coming out of Nuba. You can think of these major empires coming out of Mali, thinking about Mansa Musa and the ways in which there was so much richness, right, throughout the continent of Africa prior to European extraction, exploitation, so much liveliness that was taking place. And all of that is also a part of African diaspora archaeology, as well as understanding, you know, the role that Africa, the continent itself, the people, and the wide diversity of ethnolinguistic groups that reside there really have expanded, expressed, built, birthed into the world that we see today.
Since you went there, who sold our forefathers to the Americas? That's a question.
It's a complex.
That's a question that I'm gonna let that marinate with you guys for a couple of minutes, and then we could get into that. Because I don't want the public to think I'm just throwing softballs to you guys.
Yeah.
At some point we got.
It's a complex question. It's a complex question.
It is what it is. You know what I'm saying? So we'll break that down, because that's a part of it that I think we need some answers for as a people going
absolutely.
Forward.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So we got Ben Siegel, Justin Donovan, Ayana Flewellyn, and of course, you know, that regular name, Dr. William White, out there from Idaho, joining us this morning, and of course, the cameraman, Dave, doing all this awesome work here. We'll be back right after this.
What is the secret to happiness?
That's a really good question.
And how can we live a more meaningful existence?
Here's the secret, I think, of life.
I'm Anoush Zomorodi. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey with TED speakers who help us answer some of life's biggest questions.
Oh, wow. Yeah, let's get right to it. Join us.
Saturdays at 4 p.m. on WTJX FM.
Evictions are a form of violence.
Tiana Caldwell lives in Kansas City.
After that eviction and after being displaced, it kind of follows you for the rest of your life. You're always trying to find a way out. We have to fix this with policy.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Point is journalism that seeks solutions.
Weekdays at 10 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
Good morning, neighbor. I see you got your bumper stickers and yard sign up already.
Yes, I'm so ready for this election season.
Me too. Just waiting for the info on the polling places and then ballots.
What polling places? You mean voting centers? The election system is using voting centers this year, where you can go anywhere across the island, walk in, fill out a ballot. Just bring your ID.
Really? Because my daughter lives in Tutu, but walk all the way by the airport and would try to run back home before the sun goes down to vote.
Nope. You're no longer stuck to just your neighborhood on election day. Voting centers mean you can vote anywhere in your district. And the next time, try the early voting option too. Skip the line altogether on election day.
Girl, you have all the good tips this year, man. So, who's going to win?
Ha! Read my yard sign. Then pick any voting center. Just remember, voting is not just your right.
It's the right thing to do.
A message from the election system of the Virgin Islands.
And we're back here. We got the Society of Black Archaeologists, 11 years old, created in 2011. They had five goals in mind. I want to run through them real quick, and then we're going to get back to that question that needs some answers, or at least some discussion, because we can't provide answers for everything. To lobby on behalf and ensure the proper treatment of African and African diaspora material culture, to encourage more people of African descent to enter the field of archaeology, to raise and address concerns related to African peoples worldwide, to highlight the past, present, and present achievements and contributions that people of African descent have made to the field of archaeology, and to ensure the communities affected by archaeological work act not just as objects of study or informants, but are active makers and or participants in the unearthing of their own history. Right? So this is deep. Okay, who put this together? You? Who knocked up these tenants? That's you, Dr. Donovan?
It was a collaborative effort.
Yeah. You're a team player.
Yeah,
huh?
That's
yeah,
how we do.
I like that. So I asked this question, right? I had a discussion with my dad. He passed away in 92. So we had a discussion. Let's say I graduated from Miami in 87. And I said, what was your experience? And he said, well, there were those of African descent who looked at Black Americans as sons and daughters of slaves, and they were sons and daughters of kings and queens. That's just, you know, but that's a human thing. I'm not holding it against them per se, because there is truth in it, right? But at the end of the day, right, it's a human rights thing and not a color thing, right? That's the Malcolm X position, where what was being done to Black people in America, you don't do that to anybody. Right, so he was actually making a bigger umbrella, not just a civil rights argument, but a human rights argument. So the question is, how do we go about finding out, you know, what led to us being so sellable as people back in 1600s, as they sent us through the Middle Passage and worked our way up to the mainland, where our forefathers were used, abused, and every bad thing there is. Anybody?
I can jump in. I'm gonna pull it to one of my favorite books, actually, by Tony Morrison, A Mercy. And she actually talks about how the ways in which Europeans were able to extract and treat Black people is oftentimes indicative of how they even treated their own, right? Okay. So if you think about the ways in which European societies thought of other people mm-hmm. on that particular that sort of area of the world, they were treating each other like this. The horrors that we actually see were mm-hmm. actually inflicted upon each other. And then there's a whole discussion around the sort of globalization of race itself that came into being. And oftentimes people do talk about how there are very real, the real history of African kingdoms and the ethno-linguistic groups that did sell other Africans who we would now consider Africans into slavery. And what we also have to say is that the kind of slavery that was functioning on the continent of Africa was not chattel slavery in the sense that we had here mm-hmm. in the Americas. And in saying that, we're acknowledging that the European worldview of how to treat people, of how to actually commodify people and turn them and transform them into objects, is outside the worldview mm-hmm. of African peoples, right? It is not something that was native, indigenous on the continent itself.
And Dr. White, when you're studying archaeology, history, slavery, what are you seeing that actually pulls everything together based on your studies?
Oh, that's a big question.
You could take any part of it.
Sure. Because I've worked on a lot of different sites with folks of African descent mm-hmm. in Idaho, Arizona, Virginia, here in the Virgin Islands. And so, you know, everywhere I go, the things that people leave behind, the artifacts, the buildings in which they live, the neighborhoods and the way those things unfolded and the way that they made a living, all of those things changed throughout time and they're different, you know, in all these different sites. But, you know, one of the things that brings all these sites together is, you know, the belief and understanding and the ability to always rest assured in your Blackness. That's the thing that these African sites all over the place, and at least in the Americas where I've been, the folks, the stories of people living there are rooted in people having the African-American experience. And the artifacts change, the time periods change, the things that are going on and the dreams of the people who live there change. But, you know, folks in Idaho join together and form Black neighborhoods to, you know, find safety and camaraderie and help support each other. Mm-hmm. Folks who are enslaved in Virginia. I used to work at George Washington's boyhood home. So the folks that were enslaved there, they're also people who have come from many different backgrounds that become African Americans. They live a certain way. And, you know, when you research that kind of stuff, that common thread that you see throughout time in the experience of folks in the Western Hemisphere, that's the thing that I see in all these different sites.
No, that's awesome. No. Ben, right?
Yep.
Back in 95, right? We had just been hit by a hurricane. Maryland had devastated St. Thomas and St. John more so than St. Croix. We had gotten hit by Hugo in 89. And 95 was also O.J. Simpson trial, right? So I'm going home and I'm listening to it. And one of the things that I was always big on was trying to expand my vocabulary. And I learned this word negritude, right? And when I looked up the definition, watching Geraldo, and I heard a guy use the term, I forget his name, it was a lawyer, and he's speaking about negritude. And I was like, what? So I looked it up. And back then, it was this movement for Black scholars and literary folk back in Paris in the 30s, 1930s, right? So Ayana just spoke about exploitation in Africa, which was mostly France and England, right? Dominating, right? That Belgian, that's some Belgian influence there as well.
Yeah,
the Netherlands, right?
And the Portuguese and
Spanish,
like.
Yeah, whoever had access to boats was really.
Access to boats, okay, good, right? But I want to get back to intellectual capacity, Ben, and you, two masters, working on a doctorate. Talk about how education and being educated, which is something that we have in our political discussions, is so critical because everything that we do cycles back to knowledge. And I want you as a student, even though you might be younger, older than Ayana, you're still a baby as far as we're concerned. Yeah. Sorry to let you know that, right?
It's okay.
Talk about how critical knowledge is, and not only knowledge, but finding out the truth. Because a lot of people say a lot of things, but sometimes they're not as accurate as they should be. So talk about how critical it is when we're talking about archaeology, sure, what have you.
Well, when we got back to the exploitation and the oppression and mm-hmm. that kind of component there, mm-hmm. What came to mind to me is how powerful the concept of the other is, mm-hmm. right? So you draw your line in the sand. This is our circle. This is us. Those people over there, they're the other.
Mm-hmm.
And when you turn a people into the other, it's dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. It's lesser than.
Yeah.
And that makes you a lot more comfortable to do something to those people or treat those people differently than you would your own group.
That's a condescending mentality.
Yeah, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
And so education, I think some of the most important stuff that happens in the classroom is being in the classroom with people who don't look like you.
Mm-hmm.
You make your us, you make that circle bigger.
I'm going to stop you right there, right? One of the colloquial slangs that we have, right? When somebody tries to talk to us, we like to tell them, me not dummy or no, you ain't going to talk to me how you want to talk to me, right? That's pretty much what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
This allows for you to not be treated like a other. If you want to treat me like a other, I got news for you.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And so going into universities, going into public schools,
mm-hmm.
and seeing just all the folks from different walks of life, different backgrounds, hearing their different perspectives,
mm-hmm.
I think that is sometimes the more important lesson you're learning at school, as opposed to just, you know, what's coming out of those books.
Wow.
And so it's very, you know, worldview expanding and broadening those minds to learn more and accept more variety from the history and narratives that they're hearing.
No, that's awesome, Dave. I want to get you in here quickly because you're the cameraman. You're grasping everything. You're gonna piece a lot of things together. Your role is critical as well. Introduce yourself.
My name is David McDuffie from Chicago. Met this brother Justin at Howard some years back. Mm-hmm. We've been moving through ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's your profession, my brother, or that's just something you're doing for the project?
It's my profession. More so my life work. It's what I'm here to do,
mm-hmm.
To just move through the world, see those of us that are doing things that are in the highest of nature, and just make sure that there's proof and evidence for those coming after us,
mm-hmm.
to see what it is that we can do to...
tell the story.
Yeah. Tell the story, but
accurately.
Not so much tell the story, but to see what was going on so that we can recreate it, mm-hmm. in a living sense today. Not just as history from something from the past.
No, that's awesome. And Justin made sure that you got a chance to be a part of the discussion, because what you do is absolutely, you know, we're talking, but we're just talking. We want to see things. There are tangible things that we want to see, and you providing that.
Right, yeah. So for the last, we'll say in 2015, I started out with doing a project where I was traveling the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
going to the cities with the highest black population and percentage, just to see, do it like a time capsule for our day and age,
mm-hmm.
So that the story couldn't be told any kind of way, but those that are here and really checking for things that are on the ground could tell the stories. Tell the stories
you
ourselves.
You know, if I was to see you, Dong Tong, I would never know you as a Yankee.
Yeah. Me no Yankee though. Me never no Yankee. Maroon through and through. So when you see I and I from the States, when you see I and I from the States, never call we Yankee, man. Never call we Yankee. Maroon.
Check this out, right? We had this thing, right, where anybody who came from there, like, a lot of people were sending their children and grandchildren here for the summer, and your nickname, Yankee. No, but now, you know, we come to realize maybe that shouldn't have been the way, but that's just how it was, right?
Yeah, but to that point though, right? So like when we look at Denmark Vesey, right?
Yeah.
One of the great African revolutions in the United States, he from St. Thomas. Right,
Dave, Dave, you ain't got to tell me.
Yeah, No.
I'm not talking about Denmark Vesey. Right. No, I'm speaking. I'm gonna make a broad statement now about the greatness of the Virgin Islands as it relates to the human contribution to the existence of America.
So,
right?
So
we brag about every time you go to the ATM, right? That's Alexander Hamilton. who was educated right here at St. Croix. Mm-hmm. We had a man named William Leidesdorf, who was the first black billionaire, and he lived there. He actually created and had a great role to play with creating San Francisco, out right. in the Bay Area where you guys are at now. Camille Pizarro, great artist, born in St. Thomas. We could go on Hubert Harrison. The name's go. That's Marcus Garvey, mentor. Yes, go, so you ain't got to tell me about Denmark, Vessi. Yeah, we know what we could do.
So with that though, right, kind of goes to what Ben was talking about, just in terms of the other, right? So I built the project out as a 5-year project to go from 2015 to 2020, mm-hmm. and in the midst of doing a project, I realized that it has to go beyond just the states. It has to include the Caribbean islands, South America, and it has to include the continent too, right? Well, so this the 2020 to 2025 is also hitting the Caribbean islands.
We had I'm gonna touch on a very sensitive issue here, right? Our population tripled from 1960 to 1980, from 33,000 to 99,000, right? So clearly we needed more infrastructure and all that stuff, right? But it created a human relations problem where native versus naturalized, non-native, right? And then as time went on, we came to realize, and I'm going to come to you, Doc, because we're wrapping up this conversation. The boat just dropped off our uncles and our aunts in different islands, but we are the same people, right? But some people benefited from this divisional argument, right? Where you ain't born here and all that stuff, right? But in reality, nobody's got control over where they born, Doc.
That's one of the oldest tricks in the colonial game.
Yeah.
Like Marcus Garvey say, one God, one aim, one destiny.
Yeah, man.
And it's that vision that collectively we're all going through these things.
Yeah.
You can't survive in this place alone. No man is an island. No woman is an island.
Without adults. So check. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'll just say because of that, we have to continue to push this work so that we know the collective history in terms of how we come, in terms of the queens coming from multiple islands, ending up on this island, starting a revolt. All of those things come together here.
Without adults. So check this out, right? I want to thank all of you for making some time to come on my show this morning, right? But I'm a history major, right? So I'm not really happy with the fact that this was the first time we had this conversation. And my man's leaving later this month. I wish we had this conversation before. So Zoe Zimmet, who set this up, I want to thank her. But at the same time, you really should have been a 2-hour guest. Mm-hmm. 1 hour wasn't going to cut it. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But we made the most of the hour, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to wish all of you well. I want to thank you, Dr. Fluellen.
Absolutely. Thank you so
much. Appreciate you for having me here. Idaho Bill.
Yep, that's me. Appreciate it.
Dr. Wake, glad to have you here. My man Ben from the Bay Area and all that stuff. Miami, right? Originally?
Yeah. Right? Thank you very much for having us.
Glad to have you here. My dad graduated from Howard Med School, undergrad, everything, so.
It's a beautiful place.
So, yeah, you know what I'm saying? So it was, and then Dave, I got one quick story to tell you. Yellow Man, you know Yellow Man right there, right? He goes at a concert, and we wrapping up now, and he said, Jesus Christ, they won't blame me with camera, right? Because when he came out on the stage, they were just flashes. So whenever you see a camera, that's the way I want to pronounce it, camera, right? so it's not a camera. But Dave, thanks a lot for the contribution.
Give thanks for all you do here.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mr. DJ. In the back, great discussion here with the Society of Black Archaeologists. We're definitely going to get them back on again. And we wish him, Ben Siegel, best with his studies at the University of California. Thanks, everybody. Great show, everybody. Thanks a lot. Talk to you tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
that's happening around the world.
NPR's Frank Langfitt is in London covering this one. Hey, Frank.
Good morning.
Cuba is experiencing its biggest anti-government protests.
If it's happening here at home.
On a blistering hot day in Twin Falls, Idaho.
On the northeast border of Mississippi, where the river nourishes rich and green.
Morning Edition from NPR News will take you there, wherever the story is. Listen every weekday.
From 5 to 8 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.